Well, we are in 1 Kings 19, and we've been trying to learn how do you stand firm. And there is a spot in today's text that really takes me back, and the closest thing I can do is show you a piece of really vintage TV video from 1981. And it takes me back to when I was young. I had this habit on Saturday of watching a sports program, and that thing had been running for years and years and years. And some of you that have been around for years and years will maybe remember it, and if you haven't seen this, you will at least be able to identify why I picked that for an introductory thought to our message today. Watch this 30-second, 35-second video.
Spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of sport, the thrill of victory, and the agony of defeat. The human drama of athletic competition. This is ABC's Wide World of Sports.
There we go. We can stop that there. Now, whether you've ever seen ABC's Wide World of Sports or not, that little picture of the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat was part of that intro line for many, many years. That was a 1981 version, but you can go find other ones. And, you know, they had different people there representing the thrill of victory. But they always used that poor guy on the ski jump for the agony of defeat. And the poor guy, he was from Yugoslavia, and I might add that he landed a really, really, really good jump prior to that mishap. And so they had a series of three jumps, and that was the second one. And he has to live with that kind of fame forever. They've interviewed him because, you know, he's the face of the agony of defeat. When we are looking at today's text, there's this contrast that you might think, well, we came off of Mount Carmel. We've got the thrill of victory. And in the athletic world, you know, they're contrasting. We've got the ones that win, and then you've got the ones that don't win. And maybe there's some catastrophic reason why they didn't win. But today, the crazy part about this is we're watching a transformation between God's brave prophet. He's transformed into a cowering refugee that goes into voluntary seclusion. He's running away. Now, this isn't a contrast between two. It's one guy who's switching roles, and that's where we are today. And so, you know, if you've never read this account, you're reading along in Elijah and 1 Kings 17 and 18. Now you get to 19. And you're saying, okay, so how is God going to prove that he's God now if his prophet takes off on him? That is the question that is the purpose behind this narrative. It's to prove that God is who he said he is. So we've got a couple of scenes here. And basically, one of them is Elijah takes off, and the other one is God is meeting him and reassure him of those things. Because all of us can understand the ups and downs, the times when you feel like everything's just clicking along and life is good. And then you have those other times when you're discouraged and it feels like you've failed at things. And it can happen on the job. It can happen in the family connections and relationships. It can happen everywhere. And it can happen in one's spiritual walk, your walk with God, too. And that's true for those that are on that journey trying to figure out what does God have to do with my life. When you're putting the pieces together and you haven't really understood that that gift of salvation comes through Jesus dying on the cross in your place, and you're putting that together. But I'm saying this is true for anybody who understands that. And we look at scriptures. And one thing that I love is when God put together his message for us, and he's talking about the people who are following him, he includes it all. I mean, Noah's got a great track record with his building the ark, and isn't that something? And he found grace in the eyes of the Lord, but he had an episode in his life after the flood. It wasn't so hot. Abraham, David, Jonah. Everybody's got flawed inclusions in their stories as they come out. And so why is this important? Because none of us are likely to stand firm 100% of the time. I know I'm not. So we're going to look at this passage, and this opening scene that we find is where Elijah just simply said, I'm done. I don't want to do any more. I've had enough. And so let's read these first 8 verses together. I'm in chapter 19 of 1 Kings. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he killed all the prophets with a sword. And then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and he ran for his life, and he came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." And as he lay down and slept under a broom tree, behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones in a jar of water. And he ate, and he drank, and he lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose, and he ate and drank, and went in the strength of that food 40 days, 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. This first scene, he's no longer in Jezreel. I've got a map or two here. Now, I want you to see that the red circles up there show you the distance, and we lose that. We're seeing it in a rather limited map view, but there's a long distance, probably over 100 miles between Jezreel and that circle at the bottom, Beersheba. And that's where he finds himself moving. He's taken off, but he doesn't stop there. By the time we get to the end of verse 8, we see that he's going further south all the way to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. So the map over here on the right includes that, and you can see the scale shifts on that. You're looking at a long ways away from Jezreel, from the palace home of Ahab and Jezebel. Why would he take off, he and his servant, for that long run? I'd say it's basically because of this thing. His focus had shifted. How could that have happened? I mean, he just came off of this incredible answer from God where fire comes down and consumes his sacrifice, his offering there, and not only takes care of the animal, but the altar itself, the water that was in there. And the response of the people of Israel was phenomenal. The Lord, he is God. But how did his focus shift? What happened here? Well, according to verse 1, we start seeing that his information was really limited to what's told between Ahab and Jezebel. It says that Ahab told Jezebel that all that Elijah had done and how he'd killed all the prophets with the sword. I would just stop and say, do you see a problem with that kind of reporting? Who was the one that answered by fire? It wasn't anything to do with Elijah. It was all about God. But Ahab is telling Jezebel that that's what happened. And you know what? Here's a good takeaway for all of us. Do you see the political narrative is always one-sided? Now, that's important for us to remember today, to take your sides wherever they are. But remember that some of these things that we look at and we try to figure out where we're going to land on some issue, it may not be anywhere near the whole story. What does he know about Elijah? I mean, about Jezebel? Well, she is committed to Baal as he is to Yahweh. And she has a fierceness about her that Ahab lacked, frankly. And I think she's fixated on him. And if she can do something to cut off, because she may have seen some waffling in Ahab, is there a softening towards him? Well, if that's the case, I've got to make sure there's no more of those conversations going on. I mean, she gives him 24 hours notice that he's going to be killed, but why not just go grab him? And I think she didn't really care whether she put him to death or he took off on his own, as long as he was out of there. Because, you know, if he goes off hiding someplace, there's no social media. There's no TV reporting on the location of where he might be. He's just kind of done talking. So that's as good as anything. I think we also see that he had another reason for going into this shift in the focus, and that's that he thought he was in charge of his life. It says that he ran away because he was afraid. He ran for his life. And that's when he came to Beersheba. So he had this idea that he was in charge. And the other thing that is interesting in this, we've got this word that says that he was afraid, but if you're using a King James or New King James or New American Standard or the NIV, a lot of these translations have captured the fact that there is a variant reading in here, and they'll either use that variant in the text and footnote it or vice versa, and they'll say there's a footnote here. We aren't quite sure what this means. And so one translation will say, well, Elijah saw this and then he was afraid, then he left. And the other one says he was afraid and then he left. And it has to do with how the word is marked for vowels. And when they wrote the language, they didn't really include those. And so it was up to the person that's reading that to supply what would be the vowel sounds. Anyway, you got this variation in there, and so some of the translators included it in there. If he saw something and then fled, I think he just forgot that he is to walk by faith, not by sight. And instead of remedying this thought that he had, oh, she said she's going to kill me, man, I better take off. He could have said, but wait a minute, who's been taking care of me? Especially during these past 3.5 years. It surely wasn't Jezebel. It wasn't my own doing that kept me safe. It was God. But he doesn't seem to have that. And so he takes off on this, and he's running down the path of least resistance. I think there's one other thing that happened here, and that's that we see that he had expectations that weren't fulfilled according to Elijah's time frame. I mean, can you imagine why he took off? I mean, you hear it in some of the whining he's doing. I say whining. God asked him a question. And so whether you think that he's bemoaning the fact in verse 10 and verse 14 that God's asking him, why are you here? And he answers this with this observation, hey, I'm the only one left. What was the whole point of Mount Carmel anyway? Lord, do you remember what was recorded in Psalm 119, verse 126? Here's what that says. It is time for the Lord to act, for your law has been broken. Hey, Lord, isn't it time? Something should have happened. Now, Ahab saw the fire fall, and surely there should have been some kind of reformation happening, either personally or nationally was the goal. The people cried out, but now nothing's changed. I'm still running for my life. What was the purpose of all that? I don't think he had a long-distance view. I think he saw what he was expecting, and when it didn't show up, then he hit the panic button. As a result, his fellowship was impacted. Now, I'm going to park this in two different corners here, because as we read that text, you saw that they went to Beersheba. Now, this was a time when he had traveled with his servant to that point. But what do you suppose happened? That he was AWOL, a military term, absent without leave. He didn't have permission there. The other moves that he had were always orchestrated by God. You go park yourself by the brook, Cherith. Oh, now it's time for you to go to Zarephath. Now it's time for you to go find Ahab. You're going to meet the people on Mount Carmel. I mean, every step was orchestrated by God, and that's why this move was so significant. So he separates from listening to God's direction and does what he wants. But then he gets to Beersheba, and he makes his servant stay there, and then he wanders right off by himself. He's out in the wilderness all by himself, isolating himself from the one person that was right there the whole time. This was the servant that had to go look to see if there was a rain cloud forming. Not once or twice, but seven times. The very voice that could have reminded him that God's still on the throne. Do you realize what God had done? And he pulls back from him. That's what happens. And out of this, you see Elijah making a very irrational request. He crawls up under this tree to rest, and he says this prayer, Lord, it's enough. I've had all I can handle. Take my life. I want to die. If you really wanted that, why all the running? I mean, Jezebel would have probably helped him with that if he wanted it. It's irrational. So where did that come from? What was going on there? And then he says, you know why, Lord? Because I'm no better than my fathers, the forefathers. Yeah. Well, where in the storyline did we ever read that God expected him to be better? Where did this come from? It didn't come from Yahweh. It came from his own mind, his own thinking. He had turned everything all around, messed it all up, and said, see, I got this all figured out. Well, God met him where he was, and we see that his fullness was restored. I'm picking this up at verse 4 and following there, but we just read this story about the angel coming in, and he falls asleep, and he gets awakened saying, here's a cake of bread and a jar of water. And as I'm reading that, I go, huh. Sure enough, I went back looking. What was it that he asked of the widow at Zarephath? Could I have some bread and something to drink? The very items that God had provided there, the angel brings in and says, go ahead, you need something to eat. He does and goes back to sleep. He gets awakened again with more food, more water. And the angel says, your journey has taken a lot out of you. You're going to need it for the journey. You know what's missing in this? God didn't scold him. God didn't spank him in any way. He didn't say, oh, what on earth is going on here? He just tended to his physical needs. And then it says that from this meal that he had there, those couple of meals with the bread and the water, he went in the strength of that for 40 days to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. That's a long haul. People that would make a beeline for that spot could get there in 10 or 12 days walking, even that distance we saw on the map. And so here he takes nearly 6 weeks. And I don't know if he got down there sooner and spent some time, but something was drawing him right to Mount Sinai. Maybe he thought, this is where Moses met with God. I've got to find God someplace. There's something was drawing him there. Well, as we look to the story, we see the next phase coming in. And now, that phrase that I put there, Elijah, I just want to reassure you, that's not in the text. The other one that I showed you was, but this is my summary statement because I see God's hand in all of this. It says in verse 9 that he came to a cave and lodged in it, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, well, what are you doing here? What are you doing here, Elijah? And he said, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant and thrown down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. So the first way we see this reassurance coming in is that the Lord refreshed him, but it wasn't with bread and water this time. It was through dialogue. Up to this point, Elijah had made the statements, but there was kindness, graciousness, no other thing. But here now, God poses the question, so what? Why are you here? And then he gives the response. If that had been me, I probably would have drilled down on that a little bit. Like, if I were talking to this guy, I'd just say, did I tell you to leave your post? What are you doing here? Do you remember that every move that I made, that I told you to move, was something I told you? And here you're doing this by yourself. What's going on? Do you remember the past 3.5 years? Where'd you start? I'd make him say, Cherith? Yeah. What happened next? Zarephath? Yeah. So if all of that's true, then why? What's the problem here? That would have been me. But God doesn't do that, does he? He asks the question, he listens to the reply, and the first thing God says is, all right, I got to get you out of the cave. You move out of the cave, you stand before the Lord, and that's what he does. Gets him out there, said, you want a big display? Hang on, I can show that to you. And you see what he does. A great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake was a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. He had one show after another. The wind is literally breaking things apart, but not hurting Elijah. That's pretty impressive. But the Lord wasn't speaking. The earthquake happens, and again, Elijah's not harmed in that. And I wish there was more detail about the fire that followed. I'm thinking, what went on fire? Was this like the fire that burned the bush in Moses' day? Some kind of different kind of fire that really didn't consume things, but it passed, and it didn't harm him either. And what we find next is that it got quiet. There was a whisper, a small voice. And sometimes we read our English word whisper and we think little talking, but you can hear stuff. That word literally means in Hebrew a thin silence, quiet, stillness. It went quiet. We can't get that quiet here. The blowers of the AC units are there. We got pages and people moving, and we hear, there it went quiet. And then he hears God. What does God say? What are you doing here, Elijah? It's the same question. Even after all the big displays, and it gets down to the quiet, but he's listening now, and so he repeats the same answer again. And this is why I think there was something going on with him that revealed even a little focusing on himself in it. I'm the only one left here. And out of that, God reinstates him and tells him, I want you to go ahead and return. You're eventually going to get back to the northern kingdom. You veered off course. You did that on your own, but you got to go back. There are things you must do. And he does. And as this instruction is given to him, you see that, but it's more than just going back. I'm going to send you on assignments. He redeploys him. And when he does that, he hits three things. And we finish the details out. This threefold deployment comes in, and what do we find here? Lord said to him, go on your way. Return to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphath, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. Those quick things, so we read them, and you got to understand what is going on in the political realm, international politics. Do you know that having to anoint this king to replace Ben-Hadad. Ben-Hadad was an adversary of Israel's. And God's plan was including Damascus to give some grief to his children, getting them in line. And then he says, by the way, for Israel's sake, the next king after Ahab is going to be Jehu. So in your own country there in Israel, you're going to anoint another king. And then for spiritual matters, you've got to realize that we're still going to have someone coming in behind you, Elisha. All three of these things are interrelated. The ones that escape Hazael's purge will be dealt with by Jehu's sword. He's going to have some things that will be purged as well. And those who survive Jehu's slaughter must face the spiritual judgment by Elisha's mission from God. And then he drops one other thing. You think you're the only one left? No, there are 7,000 who have not bowed the knee. You were assuming you had all the story. You expected to have the right conclusion, but why? Because they weren't there on Mount Carmel with you? I mean, he knew some were even hidden in caves. So what happened to those? Why did he? I'm sure he felt like, boy, if they didn't show up for the showdown on Mount Carmel, they have left their post. They've resigned. They've quit. They're off doing their own thing. That wasn't the case. And he reminds them, you had 850 prophets mentioned for Baal? There are 7,000 who have not bowed the knee. You've only got part of the picture. I want you to know that this job is not done for you yet. You've got more things to do. I said we won't likely stand firm 100% of the time. So we must be alert. That because of that very thing, there are some practical application points. Fear often displaces faith if it's allowed to take hold in your thinking. I don't know if you've ever watched that happen. I have. When you start looking at the circumstances you're in and thinking, wait a minute, I can't do that. That's not my toolbox. I don't have the skill set for that. I've never done that before. I'm not that kind of person. I can't do that. And immediately, what happens? The fear starts rising before I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I start questioning my ability, and I get looking at the fear that's coming, and I get staring at that instead of thinking about the faith. What's the remedy if you get yourself stuck in that spot? You want it? You go back and you take the truth and speak it to your heart. That's what you have to do. Take large doses of it. And you know what else? How does that come? Well, from your own reading, but it can come through the relationships you have with other believers that value the same truth. You don't isolate yourself the way Elijah did, cutting yourself off from the very people when you feel yourself pulling back because this just doesn't make sense. That's when you got to step into those relationships. The reason this value up here of life is better connected is there isn't because it's an idea we have. It's because it comes from Scripture. And so when you find yourself wondering, what do I do when I'm not feeling like I can stand firm, when other things are shaking? You grab onto, you cultivate the very relationships, and you say, but they're so weak around, I don't know that I have somebody. Then take the first step and watch what God does. He will bring you into contact with people. I also think that we have to be very, very honest with ourselves. If you've ever gotten to the point where you're saying, Lord, I had enough. I got to stop. There's nothing left in me. Answer the question, why has my focus shifted? Has it shifted? If so, how did that happen here? You know, the circumstances overwhelm, yeah. Isolation, yep, yeah, I'm starting to move that direction, pulling back. I'm not nearly as involved as I once was. You find yourself thinking, my life stinks. How come other believers' lives don't stink like mine does? What is that self-pity? It's pride in reverse. You've got expectations that somehow you are beyond having to deal with those kind of things, and you've done the same thing that Elijah did with the prophets. Lord, they bailed on you. They're gone. They left their post. They don't know that. Hey, you just want to pull back and go to your favorite spot. You got to escape someplace. You want to move to Montana? That's my favorite spot. I've never been to Montana. But I got this image. It's beautiful. It's far away from people. I mean, you got to drive a distance to find people there. It sounds like the perfect spot to be when you don't. If you're from Montana, just don't tell me what it's really like, okay? Let me just live in that fantasy world. My point is, you might have your favorite spot. Life would be so sweet if I could just go there. Don't do that. You watch for that. If you think, I've been zealous for God and this is what I get, I thought there was blessing in serving God. Watch it. When that happens, you're setting yourself up for discouragement. What is the solution for that? If the other is taken in truth, I think you have to cling to Christ. You go and you celebrate that relationship. I was contemplating this, and an old song came to mind. How long has it been since you talked with the Lord and told him your heart's hidden secret? How long since you prayed? How long since you stayed on your knees till the light shone through? How long has it been since your mind fell at ease? How long since your heart knew no burden? Can you call him your friend? How long has it been that you knew that he cared for you? If I had time to rehearse all those verses in there, there's one that's talking about even getting up to face a new day is different when you're doing it with Christ. A third point, being physically spent creates spiritual vulnerabilities. So listen to the right voices. See, Elijah was listening to some messages coming through, but they weren't from God. They're a product of his own mind. And listen to other voices, that the right ones from God. I think you have to be aware of this. You can get so drained doing really good things that you don't even see it coming until you're wrung out. And that happens when we're serving, just like it did with Elijah. So for us in this church body, it is possible that some of you are really tired and you're susceptible to discouragement and depression and giving up, even though you've been serving hard. And you say, I don't get that. What happened? You might just be physically needing a break. And for the 20%, you know the old 80-20 rule that 80% of the jobs are done by 20% of the people and all of that? If you're one of those 20% people that are working hard in multiple areas at church and you look to the bench to say who can come in and substitute and you look over there and you say, well, there's no one there. I mean, some people are sitting there, but they're injured. They're healing. They can't pull in. What do I do then? And then they, frankly, they look and there might be others that are not even dressed for the game. And so they say, well, what am I going to do? I got to keep going. And the reality is, be careful. You will be vulnerable spiritually. You will look good in your role, but you're falling apart inside. Now, if that kind of nudge suddenly creates a mass exodus from all of our ministries, we'll have something to talk about again. But the point isn't that it's all going to happen at once, but you sustain that kind of energy level by having periods where you are rested, where you are connecting with God. We've got to wrap this point up. But accept the lessons experienced in the valleys. Elijah had a wonderful, glorious, crazy cool event on Mount Carmel. But he learned something about himself and about God when he was in the valley. God never left him. And so you learn to take what you are experiencing there with God and not be left with discouragement. Never doubt it. He will never leave you. Do you know that I've heard from coaches that have coached soccer teams, hockey teams like this, and they tell their teams that the greatest vulnerability you have as a team is 2 minutes after you've scored on the opposing team. You just kick it, and you watch the soccer players come racing back there, and they're running and hugging and jumping and doing cartwheels and whatever else because they scored, and it's not an easy thing to do in soccer. And within those first 2 minutes is their most vulnerable time when the game starts again because they're still mentally gone, thinking about what just happened, and then they don't pay attention to the details. So when you experience the wonderful moments of worship with God privately or together, you're at a conference, you hear some great messages at some point, you're just really enjoying the joy of leading someone to Christ and seeing tremendous answer to prayer, watch it. Next week or two might not be like that. And then you come down And that's where you're vulnerable. All this to say that this story about Elijah and how great God is so key for us understanding how are we going to stand strong in a shaky world. Let's ask for God's help. Father, the story of Elijah rings so true. His experience in chapter 19 rings so true to me. I thank you for the fact that you have equipped your church with those that can encourage and surround any of us when we feel like we're overwhelmed and tired and spent. I thank you for your graciousness. Lord, you didn't drill down on Elijah right away. You watched him get rested. You provided the rest that he needed. And then there was a time of instruction and reminding and training and redeployment. Lord, I pray that you would use this church body and that as a result of our time in this section of Scripture, life would be different for these next months ahead for us. We thank you because we know you still live, you're still on the throne, and you're still in control of everything in our world. In Jesus' name we thank you. Amen.